Well, it's my privilege this morning to welcome you to the 112th Annual Conference for the American Society for Horticultural Sciences and officially open the proceedings. So, welcome. I think it's particularly appropriate that we are back in the Big Easy this year. It has wonderful historic charms. I know I'm enjoying the food already. And we've got great things for everyone to go and see and do, and of course work in a few trips to the actual meetings while we're here. I think it's particularly appropriate because if you realize it was just 10 years ago that Katrina, the tragedy that it was here, and I'm very proud to say that ASHS was the very first large conference to return to New Orleans after the Katrina. And so in some small way, we'd like to think that ASHS contributed to the renewal and revitalization of New Orleans after that tragedy. So it's with that thought that I welcome y'all to Nawlins, as I'm told the way to say it, and we'll celebrate the city's revitalization and vibrancy, and hopefully we'll enjoy all that ASHS conference has to offer as well. I want to thank you for the wonderful turnout this morning. We have a great group of speakers and awardees, and so let's get right to it. Our 29th annual William A. Tex Frazier Lecture is Dr. Stephen Schaefer. The Tex Frazier Lecture Series was initiated in honor of William A., known as Tex Frazier, for his contributions to ASHS, horticulture, and the integration of diverse disciplines. Tex was a vegetable breeder whose last post was at Oregon State University. And he was president of ASHS in 1969. Imagine how we've changed since then. Tex died in 1995 at the age of 87, and this lecture series was established in his honor. It is one of the highest honors that ASHS has from a speaking standpoint, and we'd like to have Dr. Schaefer do that for us this morning. Dr. Schaefer has devoted his entire professional career to public service in the USDA. Effective May 20, 2014, he served as the Associate Administrator for National Programs in ARS. In this position, he's the Senior Leader and Manager for Planning, Utilization, and Budgeting in ARS's Comprehensive Agricultural Research Programs. Huge job. Prior to this appointment, he was the director of the Beltsville Agricultural Research Center from 2012 to 2014. This is the USDA's largest research installation located just outside of Washington, D.C. Dr. Schaefer has also served as the Deputy Administrator for Natural Resources and Sustainable Agricultural Systems in ARS's Office of National Programs from 2008 to 2012. This also was with a concurrent appointment as the Senior Advisor for Climate Science in the Office of the Chief Scientist of USDA from 2009 through 2010. Prior to these appointments, he's held various positions of note with ARS, the Office of Risk Management, and APHIS since 1983. Dr. Schaefer's received several important awards, including the Senior Executive Service Meritorious Presidential Award in the 2011 and the USDA Secretary's Honor Award in 2012. He received his BS in Agriculture and MS degrees from The Ohio State University and a PhD from North Carolina State University, all those in plant pathology, and he's a native of Marion, Ohio. I'm particularly thrilled. I'm from Ohio, and I went to Ohio State and NC State, so it's wonderful to introduce a fellow a Buckeye and Wolfpack a member to provide this speech, and Dr. Schaefer will be speaking to us on Partnerships for Progress. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much for that very nice introduction, Mike. It actually lasted longer than several of my jobs that I've had in USDA. Some of them have not been have been somewhat temporary along the way. But For those of you who think you saw me coming in off Bourbon Street early this morning, I just want to point out that there are places to get beignets and coffee, and I was not necessarily out on Bourbon Street. So, not that there's anything wrong with being out all night on Bourbon Street. I'm just saying. It really is a great honor for me to have the opportunity to come and talk with you. I've never attended this meeting, although the first national professional society meeting I attended was an American Phytopathological Society when I was in grad school, and it was held here in New Orleans. Of course, Mike, that was back when there were glaciers still in Ohio, but nonetheless, we've moved along a little bit. When I asked some of the folks there in headquarters and told them that I had the opportunity to come and talk with you and deliver this presentation, and I sort of asked around about some things that we might talk about that I might bring up with you, and a couple of things sort of in terms of trends kind of emerged. And one of those was that we in the Agricultural Research Service like to think of ourselves as really great partners. We seek out partnerships. We are aggressive in seeking out partnerships. We want partnerships. And the second is that we like to get things done. We like those partnerships to pay off. And so for the millennial colleagues that are in the audience, we've translated that into a tweet as Partnerships for Progress. And that's kind of what I want to talk about while we're here. So some of you already know ARS. I know some of you work for ARS, and some of you have been our partners and collaborators in the past, and we welcome that. But maybe some of you are not entirely familiar with what we do, and so I thought I'd spend the first couple of minutes talking about that and then talk about some specific areas where partnerships and collaborations can really pay off. Now, let's see. Can I do this button? I can. Great. All right. This is us in a nutshell. We are the USDA's principal intramural research agency. We have about 7,000 employees. All of them are federal employees. They're not university employees. They're federal employees. About 1,800 of those are at the PhD level, and there are scientists and engineers and veterinarians and so forth. Our budget hangs right now a little bit over $1 billion annual budget appropriated by Congress to us annually. And we use that to work on some 800 research projects around the country. We are one of four agencies in the USDA's research education and should be economics mission area. We are, of course, under Mr. Vilsack as the secretary. Some of you may know Kathy Wotecki. She's the undersecretary for RE&E. Dr. Shavonda Jacobs-Young is our administrator, has been for about a year and a half now. And then there are two associates for ARS. Myself, I'm the associate for national programs, the research programs themselves, and Dr. Simon Liu is the associate for the research operations, the logistics, the day-to-day logistics. And as I like to tell Simon, I get 90% of the budget and 90% of the fun. He gets the other 10% of whatever. But we work as a team, and we are, like I say, there are these other three agencies. The one that you're probably most familiar with is the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, NIFA. This is the extramural funding branch for the research and education and extension. I think 2 years ago you had Sunny Ramaswamy here. He's the director of NIFA, and so I think it's appropriate that we come and tell you a little bit about ARS. We also have the Economic Research Service and the National Ag Statistics Service, and those are the four agencies in the REE mission area. To deliver these programs, we are a nationally and programmatically dispersed organization. All these little dots on here are places where ARS has scientists doing research. We deliver this through five area offices. Some of you may be familiar with some of that structure, but the point is that we're all across the country. We are a national organization, and we have four labs in foreign countries as well working on looking for predators and ways to, for biological control of invasives that end up in this country. We look for their natural enemies overseas, and so we have several laboratories overseas as well. But you see we're divided up into the four areas, and you see the 90 locations. I'm going to come back to that map in a little bit. We are definitely a mission-driven organization. This is the beginning of our mission statement. You can find it on the web. I can't memorize it anymore. Those synapses died a long time ago. But to read it, it's our mission is to conduct research, develop and transfer solutions of agricultural problems of high national priority and provide information access and dissemination to. That's an important word to me. A little word right there tacked on the end, to. Because what I think that implies and sends the signal is we do this research and we address these problems, but it's not in a vacuum. We're actually, it's a very mission-driven agency, and here's the rest of it. And you see why we do this research. We're doing it to ensure these high-quality, safe food and other products, address the nutritional needs of Americans, sustain the competitive economy, enhance the natural resource space and the environment, and provide economic opportunities. There's a reason for this research, and that drives everything that we do in ARS. This is in contrast to NIFA, which you know as the extramural funding agency. This puts money in the form of competitive grants, formula funds, other kinds of funds out with our cooperators in the universities and other organizations across the country. The department and the administration, of course, has its priorities, and it's part of ARS's job as the intramural agency to respond to those and work with those. And so our research priorities are those of the administration right now. But as you see the list, this is the list of priorities. I'm sure that there include some of your priorities. And if you think back to those mission statement slides that I had a minute ago, you'd see that these fit into that structure very nicely. Now, one of the things that we always get into when we talk about ARS is, well, what's the right, you know, we'll hear this question, what's the right balance? What is ARS? Is it basic research? Is it applied research? You know, how does it balance? What's the appropriate balance? And my own opinion on that is that when you get into something like that on a mission-driven agency like ARS, those distinctions between basic and applied really get very fuzzy, blurry, gray, and it doesn't work very well. In fact, what we have is a very broad portfolio of research that at one end of the spectrum seeks to explain how agricultural systems or their components work, you know, basically physical, chemical, biological sciences. And so we work to explain how agricultural systems work, and if we get good at explaining how they work, then we can start asking questions and doing tests to find out how much predictive capability that gives us. So if we understand how something works, we can predict how maybe climate change will affect it, or a new invasive, or a change in management practices, some sort of change or pressure. How will the system respond? So if we can explain how it works, we ought to be able to predict what will happen. And if we get good at predicting what will happen under various conditions, well, then we can use that as a basis for decision support. And ultimately, that's what we're about. Somebody is going to make a decision about agriculture. That may be somebody trying to decide how to deal with a soggy area in the back 40, or the President of the United States going into a trade conference and needing to know about agriculture. And if there's a decision to be made about agriculture and it has a component that's related to science, well, we want to be there. And ultimately, this is what we're after. So all of our 1,800 scientists are somewhere on this continuum, and the goal is to drive whatever research it is that they're doing up through the explanatory power, the predictive power, and ultimately get to the basis that supports a decision on the part of somebody. So it's a very big tent. We don't worry too much about whether it's basic or applied or whatever. If it fits on this continuum and there's a clear path and we can drive it towards supporting decision making, we're there. We can't do this alone, obviously. We need a lot of partners. And we need a lot of focus on keeping our eye on the ball there at the end. And some of these numbers just give you an illustration from 2014, what this has meant in terms of tech transfer. Again, supporting decisions, getting things in the hands of the ultimate users. So in 2014, we had way over 200 active and new creative cooperative research and development agreements, over 5,200 peer-reviewed publications, over 100 new invention disclosures, 110 patent applications that were filed, and 78 that were issued. So again, these are just numbers that I give you to illustrate the point of moving toward decision support and getting information in the hands of the users. In terms of how this program is distributed, you can look at the numbers here. It's the crops and livestock and product value and environmental stewardship and so forth. But the point is this. If you aggregate up those aspects that are related to your interests in horticulture, specialty crops, production systems for specialty crops, environmental footprint of those productions and so forth, if you aggregate all of that up, it's about three quarters of our budget. In other words, about three-quarters of what ARS does has relevance to your interests and what you're doing in the universities and throughout the country and in industry and so forth. So, you know, when I come here and talk to ASHS, I think, well, I think we've got something to offer you in terms of a story to tell. Now, the research itself, the 800 projects, are divvied up into four broad areas: crops, livestock, post-harvest, I'll call it, and environment, natural resources, and systems. But then under there are these national programs, what we call national programs. And these are bundled groups of projects nationally across the country, according to these topics that you can read there, that are coordinated in such a way so that we make sure the research is complementary. Those 90 locations, it would be very easy for everybody to go off in a different direction. And what we don't want is to waste money and effort on redundant research. And so we organize it into these national programs, and this enables us to coordinate the work on five-year cycles for these programs. All of the projects are peer-reviewed. 95% or more of the peer reviewers are university researchers. We don't peer review our own stuff, and we coordinate it through these national programs. Now, I told you I was going to get back to this slide. Again, I asked the question for some of the staff back in headquarters. Redraw this map for me and show me where all of the specialty crop research in ARS is going on. And as you can see, it's really well distributed across the country. A little bit thin in the Great Plains area, but even there's about a half dozen locations. But as you can see, a huge effort on the part of ARS on research that's relevant to the interest of this group. And again, much of this research involves our partners with us. So that's where I kind of want to shift gears a little bit and talk about where these partnerships go. Ag research is part of our national DNA, frankly. It goes all the way back to the beginning. It's one of the driving forces of this country's economy for 200 years or more. I'm not an economist. You're welcome. I'm not an economist, but when I do read about economics in the large sense, the thing that I realize is that what economists say is that our economy is most prosperous and seems to be driving and healthy when we as a society are investing in three things. And those three things are innovation, infrastructure, and education. And that when we as a country are investing in those three things is when we seem to be at our best. Now, these things don't come cheap. They don't exist in a vacuum. They all require some determination and will and resources, let's be blunt, but it really requires a lot of people working towards a common goal, and that's the basis of these partnerships that make us resilient and provide a framework for our success, and in the case of research, enable us to deliver a product for the public. Now, when I say innovation in our context, I do mean research, which is absolutely key to USDA's mission. It exemplifies our investment in innovation, infrastructure, and education. The roots of our partnership between the federal government and the land-grant universities go all the way back to the beginning of when both were created. Were created by Congress, signed into law by President Lincoln in 1862. The President and the Northern Congress agreed that whatever happened in the war, however it worked out, agriculture was going to be key to rebuilding with whatever the country looked like at that point, and getting the population back on a post-war footing. And so the act to establish the Department of Agriculture was signed into law by President Lincoln on May 15th of 1862. And you can see the kind of language that was in that. That included language of practical and scientific experiments, what we would now call research. And by World War II, the USDA received about 40% of all federal research funds. Let me repeat that. 40% at the outside of World War II. I think it's less than that now. But what is today the Agricultural Research Service was created as the Agricultural Research Administration to support the war effort, and was converted into and named the Agricultural Research Service in 1953, before you and I were born, I suspect. But as far as the land grants go, the law creating the land grant institutions was signed by Lincoln less than 2 months later on July 2nd of 1862. It provided funding for an initial group of colleges focused on agriculture and the mechanical arts. Later legislation expanded the group to include historically black institutions, and then later on those serving Native American populations. Then we have the Hatch Act of 1887 that sets up the Ag Experiment Stations. So my point is, for more than 150 years, public agriculture research in the United States has run in tandem between the universities and the USDA. This partnership is what thrives today and is very important to keep it going, and it provides the foundation. Keep in mind, ARS is a national organization, so our research necessarily addresses a lot of national and even international issues of importance, but it's always done in a local context. It's, you know, ag research is place-based to a great extent, and so there's a lot of relevance to local impact. And as a general theme, this is a factor in helping us to avoid that redundancy and actually create complementary research. We share these visions, this vision of the research with the universities, and recognize that in the case of many university faculty and researchers, sometimes there's an emphasis, a heavy emphasis on grants, the cutting edge science, what you would call basic, or we could call foundational research, supported by several years of grants. But the point is that this sustained investment, long-term impact kind of research that ARS has as its mission, and you share in many respects in your interest, this is complementary with the kind of work that goes on in the university. So where I sit in the administrator's office at ARS, I see a pressing need for this to continue. This is the kind of innovation that drives us. And as far as our scientists are concerned, I think they would agree with us from where they sit as well. And where do they sit? Well, they sit at those 90 locations, but about a third of those those scientists are located on university campuses to collaborate with university faculty. And I'm a poster child for that. When I finished my PhD at NC State, ARS hired me and told me to stay there and collaborate with university faculty at NC State, and that's where I spent 14 years. It was a wonderful experience. It was a tremendous benefit to my program, and I like to think it was a benefit to NC State because I also participated in classes and mentored graduate students and participated in the academic life of the university. And I think that's the model that ARS uses across the country. This makes it very easy for us to collaborate. While we don't have this extramural funding mandate that NIFA has, we are able to share some of our resources with the universities. And this slide illustrates that for just 1 year, 2014. In that year, ARS had 359 agreements with 46 universities, totaling more than $30 million in terms of money that we were using in cooperative agreements to work with university faculty and advance common goals, common interests. These agreements are absolutely essential. The flip side of that is money that comes through grants that the university researchers are getting that we're collaborators on, and some of that money then benefits ARS. About $23 million came back into the labs of our scientists in the last fiscal year. So this just is a monetary illustration of the extent to which the collaborations work and how effective these can be. So how effective are they? Well, the proof is in the results, isn't it? What have we accomplished in these? I think everybody in this room is familiar with this. This is the USDA plant hardiness zone map that was worked out with ARS in collaboration with Oregon State. It was released to the public in 2012. It crashed the server when it got put online. It's made, you can print it, but it's actually made that you can enter your zip code and it will tell you what which of the plant hardiness zones that you're in. And like I said, it crashed the server when we released it. It got 2 million visitors in the first 12 months and gets thousands upon thousands upon thousands constantly. So this is a great illustration of a collaboration. It's also, I think, a pretty nice looking map. It's the one that I have hanging in my office rather than the typical geopolitical map. Citrus greening, everybody in this room knows about that. Those of us who are plant pathologists also are quite interested in that. It's a huge challenge to the industry, probably the biggest threat to the citrus industry that we faced. It's going to require putting a lot of heads together to address this. And that's exactly what we're doing. ARS and university partners are really addressing this quite well. We've got, we're establishing some tolerant varieties and quickly getting those propagated. We've got scientists in Fort Pierce, Florida, working on working on this in collaboration with the University of California, the Florida Department of Ag and Consumer Services, University of Florida. We've got some grant money from NIFA that we're working with our university partners on the psyllids. A lot of partners on that, including UC Davis and University of Florida, and then, of course, APHIS is involved with this as well. So if I were a psyllid, I would be worried because we've got a lot of people really throwing a lot of firepower at this, and it shows our collective capability of responding to a threat. Here's a neat device worked out with the ARS and a university partner. It's a tool that has immediate payoff for the industry. One of our ag engineers, Herping Zhu, who's at Worcester, Ohio, worked with three different universities to devise what they're calling an intelligent sprayer that monitors the shape of the canopy and the leaves and the density of the canopy and adjusts the pesticide application rate as it moves. It's constantly monitoring this and makes this adjustment automatically. There's a lot of savings of this. It has in some settings reduced the pesticide application rate down to a third of what it had been, and the cost savings can be well over $200 an acre. So this is something that was worked out and is put in the field almost immediately. What we're calling banker plants, again, this is a collaborative project. As horticulturalists, you know that predators and of insects will move around quite a bit to wherever they can find their prey. That brings us to whiteflies. In the case of this particular project, also in Florida, this is an issue on poinsettias, whiteflies on poinsettias. So you put out these banker plants, the whiteflies attack them, the predators go in there as well, and the result is that you raise the population of the predators that can then move around from one year to the next, and you get sort of a sustained application that you could go back to. I don't think these wasps have sting, or I could make some horrible joke about this being a sting operation, but I don't think that works in this particular case. Urban farming, this is something that we're hearing more and more about. You are, as well as we are in ARS. We've had some budget initiatives before in the president's budget that we'd like to do this. This is to adapt agricultural practices and many of our crops to urban settings and vertical farming settings. We think that about half of the ornamentals and floral crops and vegetable crops could be adapted for these kinds of environments. And again, we're working with partners in the universities. One of the products out of this is the virtual grower model that helps greenhouse growers design lighting and energy systems and predict crop growth under these. So there's all kinds of things going on with this. Now, I've talked a lot about the innovation, and now let me shift gears to the infrastructure. There are some great examples of innovation that arise from these partnerships with the university colleagues, but we really need to talk about infrastructure as well, because it's more than just about having the intellectual capacity to carry out the task. In ARS's case, nationally, at those 90 locations and the four overseas, the replacement value for our physical plant is about $4 billion. And we've estimated that we need about $150 million a year just to tread water with that, just to keep things in repair, not build new, not do more, but just to keep those in good repair. In addition, we've got thousands of acres of farm and rangeland. We've got insect and culture collections and germplasm collections and so forth. So we need all the help that we can get with that as well. I think it was President Wilson that said, I not only use all the brains that I have, but all that I can borrow. And we need to do that in addition with not only with the innovation, but with the infrastructure as well. A great example of our infrastructure in collaboration with universities are the Human Nutrition Research Centers. There are six of these. Three of them are standalone with ARS. Three of them are located on university campuses. They're jointly operated by ARS and the university. A lot of the people in them are MD, PhD types that would be hard to hire into the federal system, but they are hired into the university system. And we build the buildings, provide about half the operating budget, and we put our scientists in there with university scientists at the centers. This has a big payoff in terms of attracting students, doing collaborative research, and on down the line. And we discover things like the compounds in red wine that allow you to drink red wine and have a health benefit. and you're welcome. Another area that represents infrastructure is our national plant germplasm system, and here I want to do a shout out to Dr. John Priest, our research leader at with the ARS National Clonal Germplasm Repository in Davis. He's one of the new ASHS fellows. Congratulations to John. He's part of a really an amazing infrastructure for the germplasm system. We've got 20 gene banks across the country, many of them at university facilities with crops and genetic stocks, modern varieties, old varieties. And you know the importance of this in finding the diversity of resources to go after things like climate change and pests and so forth. We may never know the total value of those resources, but with new tools and bioinformatics and genome sequencing and so forth, we're learning what a treasure those really are. You can see on these two graphs, this is a pretty critical resources for scientists both inside and outside ARS. Since 2008, the National Plant Germplasm System webpage has had over 2 million hits per year. And in recent years, we get at least 200,000 requests for germplasm samples themselves from all over the world. So this is a huge resource for breeders and people working on problems that can be dealt with by genetic means. This slide gives, I think, a good idea of exactly how diverse those plant germplasm holdings are. This is vegetable crops alone. We have about 100,000 accessions in 15 plant families for vegetable crops alone. It's a huge resource, and it increases every year. These accessions have been increasing for quite a long time. This all got started historically with plant collection trips of botanists and horticulturalists. This has been going on since President Lincoln created the whole thing. This is a slide of two of USDA's most intrepid plant collectors, Dr. David Fairchild, who established the USDA's Office of Foreign Seed and Plant Introduction. Imagine just bringing in seeds all over the place and stuff now. Try that. And Dr. Frank Meyer, who is an immigrant from the Netherlands, who in 1902 started working at the introduction station in California. Meyer got around a lot. He had some really nice hats. He started with his first trip in 1905, and the fourth and last one ended in 1918 to China and Japan, where he was focusing on pear germplasm, trying to collect pear germplasm from the points of origin, because there was a pear blight disease going on in the United States, and he was looking for that. He was not always the happiest traveler. He wrote letters back to Fairchild, and I'll quote from one. It says, in the end, the vermin is he wasn't much of a grammarian either. In the end, the vermin is exceedingly plentiful and bloodthirsty, and ordinary travelers have to sleep three abreast in one bedstead or on one broad bench, and the stinkingly dirty bed covers are kept in use until they fall to pieces. So, those of you who work for the federal government, be happy what the per diem is today here. We all gripe about it, but we don't have to, you know, do that. Modern-day plant collecting trips, I think they're a little bit better, although they do have to push the vehicles out of the mud once in a while. We still have people doing this around the country, and partners on these trips include many from the university, including and other organizations like the Morris Arboretum in Philadelphia and others. And we are actually still curating some of the samples that Frank Meyer brought back in the early 1900s. Some of it, you're familiar with the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. This is up between Norway and the North Pole someplace. And ARS has a number of samples in that vault, including some of from our pepper germplasm development. I guess we were trying to send some heat up that way, but the ARS does have a large effort in breeding peppers. Another bit of infrastructure, just to mention, I'm going to do this real quickly because we can talk about this one a long time. Is ARS, in collaboration with its partners, has created a long-term research network for agroecosystems. Some of you are familiar with the LTER, Long-Term Ecosystem Research Network, started by NSF several decades ago. This is for the agricultural side of the house, and this is an infrastructure that will enable us to look long-term at things like sustainable intensification and trying to feed 9 billion people by the mid-century. The idea is ARS already had a lot of this infrastructure, so did the universities. why should we spend tens of millions of dollars to create something new? Wouldn't it be better to put that investment in the research itself? So that's where we invested it. This is the network as it exists right now, 18 locations. Most of them are at ARS locations, but we also have the R.J. Cook Farm at Washington State. We have a site with the University of Nebraska. We have the Kellogg Biological Station with Michigan State, and the Archibald Biological Station, which is a nonprofit, an NGO in Florida. Just looking at the university partners with these, there's all over 60 university partners nationally and internationally that are already working with us collaboratively on the LTAR network. And if you look at just the sites themselves, the 18 sites, some of these go back for more than 100 years in which we have environmental data. Some of them are quite large in terms of in terms of square kilometers. We are trying to coordinate this with NSF's NEON domains. We are in 12 of the 18 major drainage basins of the United States and 8 of the 9 ERS farm resource regions. My point is this. When you look at what this is trying to accomplish, research questions that are shared and coordinated across the sites, the capacity to address large-scale questions, looking at comparable data sets, shared engagement, we really, really need university partners in this. And we created it with the intent of having university partners. So if you want to learn more about this, see me, but we definitely encourage your participation in this. Basically, the principles of operation require us to create a consortium. And that's what we're all about. All of this leads to big data. We all hear about big data. I don't know exactly how to define big data. I think it's something between humongous and ginormous. But we talk about it a lot, and ARS is investing in it, and we need, again, university collaboration. We're proceeding with the development of an Ag Data Commons prototype, which is an open agricultural data system that allows a general public to have access to it, that will have some metadata standards and some basis for making that uniform. Another item on our to-do list with respect to big data was join the Internet 2 as an agency. Some of you in the universities already have access to Internet 2, but ARS as an agency did not. We've established that, and we've created a high-speed network called SciNet. It's designed for the transfer of very large data sets very quickly among ARS and collaborators through Internet 2. So we're very busy on that. Our acting chief scientific information officer has got our hands full with that. And the other place where we have a lot of information, of course, is the National Agricultural Library, one of four libraries owned and operated by the federal government. These are old seed catalogs that might interest some of you, but the collection houses a lot of rare books and old manuscripts and so forth. But the library doesn't exist only in the past. It's part of an overall infrastructure for things like PubAg, which has full-text access of thousands of journal articles. We are going to be the home for the I5K, the genome Insect Genome Project, and literally thousands of digitized holdings. So the National Ag Library has its work cut out for it as well, and is a resource for all of the ag community. Last, I talked about innovation and infrastructure. Just real quick, let me wrap up with education. We don't have a mandate for education. We do not, we're a purely research organization. We do not do education formally, but obviously we have a huge vested interest in who's the next generation of scientists, who are the next group of cadre of scientists that we're going to hire, and this has obviously got to be highly collaborative. Every year our scientists work with students. I worked with students when I was at North Carolina State, and you can look at some of the numbers that are on here, and the one number that I really want to point out is this one. 1,094 ARS scientists in 2014 held adjunct appointments. Now, you remember one of my earlier slides, I told you we had about 1,800 scientists. Well over half have some sort of an adjunct appointment at a university. This is extremely important to us. We like to think that it's very important and useful and important for you, and this enables us to train the next generation of scientists. We've got a big stake in that. And I just encourage that this continues. I think this is such a benefit to the public. So I'm going to wrap up. We've had some examples here of how effective partnerships between ARS and the universities and the partners can deliver for us. These collaborations must continue. We simply don't have the resources to do these things on our own, or you do it individually. We've got to be able to leverage this. And I think we're going to be able to sustain the benefits that we've had over the past 100 years or more if we continue to look at the value of these partnerships. Yeah, some money changes hands, and that's important to us both. But the real value is in the day-to-day, shoulder-to-shoulder, you know, leverage each other's resources, pick each other's brains, and really work together. That's the importance of this, and those kinds of things need to continue. The way we plan varies. NIFA plans a little bit differently than we do, universities do, but we need to keep our planning processes, those lines of communications open, so we know what each other is doing. You know what the federal labs are doing. We know what you are doing, and so forth. And that happens through those university, those people that we have at university campuses. Competitive funding. We're on a lot of grants together. That needs to continue. I don't think it really matters who's on the PI line. What really matters is what is it we're going to deliver for the taxpayers, and we need to continue for that. And all of this keeps us where we want to be at the cutting edge of the research and the delivery of the impact. So here are the takeaways I want to leave with you. I think that, budget concerns aside, our future success is certain if we as an agricultural community that make up this tandem federal university system stay focused on investing in these three things. Innovation, we need new knowledge. We've got to keep the knowledge pipeline coming that we can put these into agricultural solutions for America and the rest of the world. Infrastructure, it's tough to maintain it. It's expensive. How can we do that together? We need to share those facilities, share the tools, share the expertise, and expand our options for how we do that. And that will, I think, increase our output and our impact. And finally, education. We need to work with the students now to ensure that in the future we're able to turn our laboratories over to the best scientists we possibly can, who can conduct the best research and know how to communicate it to the public that will continue to support it. I think that anything that serves those three needs, innovation, infrastructure, and education, is certainly deserving of our collective attention, and I really believe it's going to contribute handsomely to our future success. So at ARS, keeping those goals in mind really reminds us of one of our priorities, and that's what it's all about, and that's collaborating and partnering for progress. So that's what I have to say to you today. Thanks very much for your time, and I don't know if there's time for questions or anything, but we'll do that, and I'll give you the floor back, Mike. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I just wanted to take a moment, and Dr. Schaefer, to thank you for that wonderful lecture. And we'd like to induct you as an honorary member the American Society for Horticultural Sciences.
Thank you very much.
And so thank you, and we'll look forward to partnering with USDA, ARS.
Good. Thank you very much. Thank you.
It's not often that we have the opportunity to do something momentous, and I think it's an opportunity today. And that is, we get a chance to induct a person into the Hall of Fame for Horticulture. And that's quite a momentous occasion. As you know, the Society gives its most prestigious award to honor designated persons who have made monumental and unique contributions to horticulture. We offer the Horticulture Hall of Fame Award to educate and increase the awareness of our younger members of the profession and the general public about the important contribution of horticultural pioneers who have made significant impacts on horticulture. ASHS is exceptionally pleased to induct an outstanding contributor to horticulture in the Hall of Fame this year, and that is George Washington Carver. Okay. He will not be with us today, George Washington Carver holds an unprecedented place in American life, in horticulture and agriculture, in science, in industry, and in social history. He overcame great personal adversity to become the first African-American scientist in the United States. In 1984, Carver received his bachelor's degree in agriculture and 2 years later a master's of science in agriculture from Iowa State University of Science and Technology. He was not only the first African-American student at Iowa State, but he was also the first African-American faculty member, where he served as a short time as an assistant botanist in the experiment station. Carver was called then by Booker T. Washington to join the staff at Tuskegee University in Alabama in 1896. During his tenure at Tuskegee, Carver established an international reputation. He was an effective educator, an innovative researcher, and made great contributions towards the revitalization of Southern agriculture at a terrible time in America's history. He is most often remembered for the research that resulted in the creation of more than 300 products from peanuts, one of my favorite foods, as well as 100 products from sweet potatoes. You will receive in each of your registration bags a summary of just a few of the achievements of this outstanding individual. And there's also a poster on display in the exhibit hall that encourages you to stop there as well as online and learn more about George Washington Carver and his many accomplishments. This plaque will add much to the Horticulture Hall of Fame at ASHS headquarters. Join me in welcoming George Washington Carver into the ASHS Horticulture Hall of Fame. Wonderful thing. I was probably far overlooked and he should have been in our inaugural class. So that's great to add Mr. Carver into that. That brings us to one of my favorite parts of the awards program, the plenary session, and that is the induction of the 2015 class of ASHS fellows. I'd ask each of the fellows, as we read off some of your accomplishments, to join me here on the stage, and I think Mary Meyer, our chairman of the board of directors, is going to join me. And come on up and then return to your seat afterwards. Okay? Our first inductee into the ASHS 2015 class of fellows is Dr. Randolph V. M. Beaudry from Michigan State University. If you can come on up whenever we read you off. Okay. Dr. Beaudry has been an ASHS member since 1984. He's published 34 articles in the ASHS journals, and this is only roughly 30% of his 112 refereed publications. Dr. Beaudry's research productivity has resulted in 4 patents, 10 books, 2 reviews, 162 presentations, 56 invited national and international speaker engagements, and over $5 million in grant funds. These funds came in an array of industry sources and federal grants to support a range of products on modified atmospheric packaging and design, fresh cut product safety, fruit and vegetable aroma biology, apple, mango, sugar beet, potato, and blueberry storage, plant growth regulation, 1-MCP utility, breeding of Stevenia, and mechanical harvesting. Is there anything you haven't done? Dr. Beaudry has served extensively as an industry consultant in the post-harvest arena. His international speaking invitations include Malaysia, Brazil, Chile, the Dominican Republic, Argentina, Germany, Belgium, Spain, India, and New Zealand. He has twice been invited to speak at the Gordon Conference of Post-Harvest Physiology, and he's served on 8 review panels in 5 different organizations, also as an associate consulting editor of Hort Science, on the editorial board of Post-Harvest Biology and Technology. Dr. Beaudry has advised numerous PhD and master's students and served on graduate student committees in many departments and countries, including New Zealand, Holland, Canada, and Australia. He served as the interim department chair and currently serves as the department's graduate program coordinator or director. Very thankless job, by the way. Dr. Beaudry received numerous awards, including the USDA Group Honor Award for Excellence, an ASHS Fruit Publication Award, a Golden Award for International Horticulture Congress Poster, the Distinguished Service Award from the Michigan State Horticulture Society, and Fruit Man of the Year from the Michigan Palmisters. And I learned that that is the pomology industry, right? Okay. Dr. Beaudry serves the fruit industry as a resource for apple and blueberry harvest maturity, disorders, and storage recommendations. He's a faculty coordinator for the MSU Apple Maturity Program. And he has developed over 70 outreach articles primarily for the Michigan apple industry. Dr. Beaudry, welcome to the 2015 class of ASHS Fellows.
Thank you so much.
By the way, suitable plaques for this have been sent to their homes and should be waiting them on arrival to save in travel issues. Our next member of the 2015 class of ASHS Fellows is Dr. Joanne R. Davenport from Washington State University. Dr. Davenport is an internationally recognized soil and plant scientist with an impressive 30-year career as an outstanding researcher, educator, and prolific author of publications in the field of plant nutrition management for crop yield and quality. She's currently located at Washington State's Irrigated Agricultural Research and Extension Center in Prosser. Dr. Davenport's research is focused on nutrient cycling through soil plant systems and perennial fruit crops with an emphasis on site-specific management of plant stress. Her research has been supported by over 100 grants, a tribute to the value of her work as recognized by numerous agricultural stakeholders. She served as the senior agricultural scientist and manager of agricultural research with Ocean Spray Cranberries Incorporated until 1996 when she accepted a faculty position at Washington State. I understand they want a profit there.